Hello and welcome to The President's Perspective, a monthly half-hour chat with the interim president and CEO of Texas A&M University Commerce, Dr. Ray Keck. I'm Jared Knight. On today's program, Dr. Keck introduces a guest who holds the title of Henry Charles Lee Professor of History at Princeton University, where he's also the director of the Global History Lab. He's been the director of the Council for International Teaching and Research, the director of the program in Latin American Studies, and the chair of the History Department at Princeton. Our guest has taught at Oxford University and the University of Essex in England, and at the Instituto Torquato di Tella in Argentina, among others. He's been awarded the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Fellowship and the Frederick Burkhardt Fellowship of the American Council for Learned Societies. Dr. Keck, if you would.
Jared, thank you for having us today, and welcome Professor Edelman to Commerce to East Texas. I've known this man for a number of years and observed him as a scholar, a teacher, a thinker, a friend to teachers and to students. He was here to share with us a chapter from a book, forthcoming book, about the power of imagery, photography, and moral consciousness. So perhaps we start with that, Jeremy. Talk to us a little bit about what it is that the camera brings to our moral sensibilities.
Well, thanks, Ray. And it's been a wonderful couple of days here getting to know colleagues and students at Commerce. I actually got into this project through the back door. Most times when we think of books that we're working on, there's an idea in our mind, and that idea gets chewed over and developed by reading other books and going into libraries and archives and talking to colleagues. In this particular case, I was working on a book and slowly realized how important photography was. And actually, it started with a realization that many of my students were more visually attuned to the world than I was. I mean, I come from a generation that read texts, that still looks at something on a screen, on a computer, or sometimes even my phone as a text, and I read it that way. But I watched my students looking at material in a different way. They were visual rather than literate, or visually literate rather than textually literate. And I started to wonder how much of our imagination thought that way. So went back into the history of photography, realizing that there's been a discussion and a debate about how images create the people that we are, not just the text, the newspapers, the pamphlets that we happen to read along the way. So it was actually really thanks to conversations with students and thinking about sources that they could then read and think about in classes. And I began to, for those of us who are textually inclined, this was sometimes a difficult decision to let the texts go to make room for importing visual imagery and tell the stories about those images and have the students think aloud between themselves about what they saw in photographs and the stories behind photographs. So it was largely through students. The other was, as I was working on this, was very struck by how public opinion more generally was getting walloped by very strong, arresting, disturbing images, much more than the news stories themselves, or rather the news stories were the packaging, and that the really precious part of it was the photograph around which the story was wrapped. So the famous images of Syrian children, of bombing, and then, of course, I went back, Vietnam photography, atomic testing photography, thinking about the ways in which we imagine the world and our interconnections through these images, and realizing how much there's been a debate behind the stories about the use and danger and possibility of photographic imagery. Now, I realized, actually, my students are just elevating this conversation to a new level. And I just was completely unaware of it as a 19th century historian who read texts in a different way. So it wasn't a very linear dissemination. I hadn't started out with this idea and wanted to pursue it. It was more a discovery in the course of watching other people think about how they related to the materials around them.
One of the many insights that you shared with us last night was the challenge, really, you gave our students, and that is to carry a camera to enable you to see differently.
Yeah.
Talk a little bit about what that means.
So most of us now, our cameras now are our phones, mm-hmm. for most of us. Mm-hmm. We take casual photographs like Polaroids, only we can keep them digitally, of random encounters. And we don't think of the taking of the photograph of as a special moment. And there are various technological features to that. One is the absence of something called the viewfinder. I'll come back to the viewfinder in a minute. But I came late also to cell phones for a variety of reasons. But when I was younger and an undergraduate, like the undergraduates I was meeting yesterday, I always had a camera and traveled around the world with a camera. I wanted to be a photojournalist. I wanted to chronicle images, chronicle the world's history through images of it. I then just became a boring historian. But the idea of the photograph, of capturing world historical moments through everyday lives of people, landscapes, historical processes, was always there. What the camera had done for me when I was traveling to work in refugee camps or other kinds of things that I was doing, thinking about being a recorder of the world, was make me look at my environment differently. Because when you look through the camera, you're not, as we now do through our cell phones, looking at a unbounded landscape in front of us. You're looking through this thing called the viewfinder. So it's framed from the beginning. You have to think about the composition of the photographic image itself. And as soon as you start to think compositionally, you start to see the depth of field. You start to, I'm looking out the window in this studio and I can already see the layers pile and the different stories inside each layer. That the existence of the viewfinder and looking through the camera and the lens, now we look through lenses. They're different. They're optical viewfinders. There are different kinds of viewfinders. But it either way, you're looking through a box, which was the original 19th century incarnation of the camera. Now we don't. Our cell phones are not like boxes. And so that's what made me realize that a lot of framing goes into the art of the photograph. And so when we tell stories, write narratives, we are also framing. It's not such a different act to signify the meaning of something through the way in which we frame it. And so I spend a lot of time when I'm teaching helping students think about, well, what's the frame of the story you're trying to tell? Or what's the framework of the image? What's the context? What are you leaving out? What are you putting in? Why are you making these decisions about what to put in? And how does that change the nature of the story?
Well, what you're describing sounds much closer to painting than is often admitted. Yeah. You remember when the camera first was invented, will this put painting out of business? Yes. Well, no, because the painting requires the sort of composition on the part of the painter, the creation of the reality and the layers he wishes.
Right.
The camera was thought to simply reproduce what was prosaically there.
Yes.
You're suggesting something very different.
Well, up to a point, though there has been a debate, as you noted, about whether how much photography is like painting. Mm-hmm. And at the very beginning, many photographers, I talked about a few of them last night, like Roger Fenton and Felice Beato, the very first photographers of war, thought of themselves as painters. They would arrange the landscapes and the scenes of battles, oftentimes without any soldiers there. In the famous Shadow of the Valley of Death by Roger Fenton, he's taking skulls and boulders and moving them around in the valley after the Light Brigade has gone through to create a dramatic stage.
Right.
And to try to get the viewer to imagine what must have happened here as a battle unfolded. And so they were constantly arranging and framing what was going on in the same way that you'd imagine they imagined a painter adding a branch or some clouds or embellishing in a portrait. They didn't think of themselves as practicing such a different artwork.
Mm-hmm.
It's really not till there emerged, after around 1900, a movement of what we call photographic objectivity. The idea that the photographer, the cameraman, could take, could quote unquote shoot an image and take in, as it were, a snapshot of reality that was not constructed by the photographer. The art of the photographer was to capture the moment and its realism, and that the photographer was an objective recorder of the global moment. Then you get a rupture, and it partly had to do with the change in the nature of the camera itself. It was now more portable. You didn't have to have a tripod. Eventually, they put in canisters of film instead of glass plates. In the old days, in the 19th century, you'd have to, it was a long process to set up one of these cameras, and it did look a lot like an easel. So you had to spend a lot of time arranging people, getting them to pose. It looked like portraiture. Once the camera became more mobile and you could take serial photographs, it began to change. And then by the 1930s, we get really the with a whole set of landmark photographers, the move to photojournalism also as a career apart, as a vocation apart, where the heroic photojournalist, and this is what I thought I was doing when I was a kid, right, was going out into the world and snapshotting the world as it was, not as I created it. And so even in the debates about photography, there's been some controversy about what it really is.
Does it capture a moment? Is it truth-telling?
Yes.
For that instant?
That's right.
Or is it reaching toward a wider truth?
That's right.
About a theme, an event, a point in history.
Right. And how much the photographer is constructing it,
yes,
rather than just representing it. And so there's a very famous photograph, as you know, the Robert Capa photo. So Capa would become one of the great photographers of the 20th century, really the pioneer of modern photojournalism, would take the famous photographs of D-Day in 1944, a very controversial photograph taken during the Spanish Civil War of the Republican soldier being shot from behind. He's falling down, what appears to be onto the photographer himself. At the time, the photograph was sensation. Nobody had seen on such a widespread scale the photograph of someone being shot. All right. It was very dramatic, and the very movement of the body itself was very disturbing at the time, when there was a big debate going on about, you know, who to side with in the Spanish Civil War. And this idea of Capa himself being among the fighters, right? The idea that the photojournalist was, quote-unquote, shooting while the soldiers were shooting was part of the allure of the capturing of the moment of the drama. And, of course, there's been a there ensued a controversy about that photograph. Was it staged? Was the soldier really killed? Or did he play act so Capa could capture what surely must have been going on at the time? But the issue of the authenticity of the image, which we still continue to have nowadays in the age of the selfie and photoshopping. And, well, it turns out that this issue goes back to the charge of the Light Brigade. And there's been this debate about photo, how objective is it really from the very beginning?
Well, you talked and when we began about your own shift and many in our generation from textualist to followers of imagery, readers of images, and you talked last night at some length about the relationship between the explanation of the picture or the text that goes with the picture and the picture itself. I, thinking about a famous example to sort of test that idea, one remembers from our history the tremendous inventory of photographs taken by Matthew Brady, particularly of Abraham Lincoln.
Yeah.
When we look at them now, Lincoln seems in almost Olympian calm, but we know that's completely at odds with what was happening inside him and around him.
Oh, yeah.
If we didn't know that, how would we respond to that picture? Would we be able to look at those photographs and see as much as we do, or are we dependent upon the text to tell us what was really behind it?
Yeah, those are great questions. Portraiture like that, portraiture of Queen Victoria, this really in the beginnings of early photography, the landscape and the portrait were the two dominant genres. And again, they did not think of themselves as that different from painting. And opposing the subject, like Abraham Lincoln or Queen Victoria or the last Mughal in India. These were all photographs taken in the 1850s and 1860s. Just moving out of what's called daguerreotype was enormously important. And in part, the photographs were taken for a public function to convey a story, an image of authority, wisdom, justice. They were hired to take photographs with this purpose in mind. The difference between the painting and the photograph, what they all recognized at the very beginning, was the photograph was more easily reproduced onto print. So you could start to take the images and the portraits and put them into circulation. That they figured out relatively early on. By the 1850s, you begin to have newspapers and magazines that include, it's not just text, they start to include images, drawings, and increasingly photographs. And by 1900, they had figured out how to print black and white photography with some fidelity onto cheap newsprint. Of course, right at the time, Wars of 1898, the fallout of what was happening around the world right on the eve of the First World War, that newspapers can suddenly now put black and white prints into them. So photographers were aware that the images had circulatory possibilities that paintings didn't have, but so did the subjects. And so they used these images to convey certain properties and powers. For the case of Victoria, we know also was to circulate this image of imperial majesty. She was also the emperor of India. And so it was very important to convey the sense of authority and morality on the part of rulers. It was much more easily managed iconography in those days than what the revolution that's happened in imagery now. Anybody can take a snapshot. It can circulate instantly. It's been, in this sense, democratized. Mm-hmm. It was much easier to curate in those days and to control and to manage. Now, much harder. Right? And so that's the big shift that's happened from the 19th century. The concepts are still the same, right? That we manage the images and we embed them in stories, and the images are meant to illustrate a story.
Well, and talk a little bit about that, appending stories to images. Yeah. How does that happen? And can't the same image then be repurposed by a new story?
Absolutely. And that is also what they discovered fairly early on in the process. And is now what goes on in an image that we find very disturbing is itself, it's a battleground for rival narratives. Because people know that the significance of the image depends very much on the story that you wrap around it. Let's just take a famous image that I'm sure many of your listeners will know about, and many of my students know, they've seen it in textbooks. It's the image taken in 1971 of the execution of what looks to be a civilian in Saigon.
Mm-hmm.
A general, a South Vietnamese general. And the New York Times and all major newspapers plastered the photograph on the front page of newspapers around the world. And it was a horrific sight. The idea that the United States was in cahoots with this band of murderous rulers who were taking out civilians in the streets. I won't go into the history of the photograph itself, except to say that the public, and even the New York Times to some extent, allowed that image to be wrapped around a story of the United States being dragged into a depraved, in alliance with a depraved regime in South Vietnam. And it was in a very important photograph for tilting American public opinion against the war, which had been shifting in any event. In fact, that story, what was going on in the photograph, was much more complicated than that. It turns out that the quote-unquote civilian who's being shot, executed in the street in Saigon, was himself an assassin working for the Viet Cong. That the man who did the shooting was a general who had whose troops had captured the subject at a mass grave site where the assassin had gone to make sure that the policemen and the families of the policemen that he'd been shooting were being buried, and he's captured there. many observers objected to the photograph, found it horrific because they felt it was also staged. And the photographer himself argued later on that he hadn't staged it at all. This was another case of the Coppa phenomenon, that he was snapping photographs of an unfolding story. And what the New York Times chose was just that one moment of the execution. Not what happened to the cadaver afterwards. Not images of the man being captured and struck, you know, and the discussions in the street beforehand, nor even of the other people who were in the midst. It's just a pure image of the killer and the victim. And so the story about the Vietnam War was getting recast in this way when you could have told a very different story about what was happening in that moment. But the dominant view was this one: a murderous regime, an innocent civilian shot in the street. That's the story to which this image was going to be purposed. The editors of newspapers had chosen to frame it this way.
And don't we live with that same phenomenon now? The last year, the repeated examples of young, particularly African American men, shot in what appears to be a completely defenseless posture.
That's right.
And then as we explore the reality, it's far more complex.
Yes.
Repugnant and revolting as it seems, it's never quite as clear.
That's right. That's, in fact, so fast forwarding, as I think about my own increasing visual literacy and what's going on behind the stories of photographs, thinking that we have to develop some capacity in an increasingly visualized and digitized world of being able to think critically about images. With the same kind of facility that many of our wonderful colleagues can do in the world of art history for painting and for sculpture and so on, we need to find strategies and ways of doing this in a digital world. I think as educators, this is something we have to do. And in working on this book, one of the intentions is to have a reader, my students, think about the news that they digest in a more critical way. And so, yes, these horrific images of shootings in the street, to have a viewer or a viewer reader, let's hyphenate them, look at those kinds of images and think critically, well, what's the story behind the image? The victim has a story. The shooter has a story. How do we put these, how do we conjugate these stories together? That's the job of the historian, to produce a sense of what happened, why it happened, and what it means to us morally and politically. So anyway, that's one of the ambitions of this book, to think then about these global images. But yes, nowadays we're having this problem right now.
Well, we come around then. We began, you were contrasting textuality and imagery, reading words, reading images. Point of view really becomes a crucial issue. We used to talk about that in literature, and now certainly point of view. Talk a little bit about the power of point of view now, as it informs how we look at these things. You're alluding to it when you talk about the shooter, the victim.
Yeah.
Each has a story.
Yeah.
How do these points of view somehow reach the level of public policy, popular opinion, moral decisions?
Yeah.
How do we harness this new wonderful tool of this new way of perceiving to inform our deeper need for justice, for mercy, for a fair society?
Understanding, and there are different points of view. There's the point of view of the photographer. Try to imagine what the photographer is seeing when he or she takes the shot. There's the point of view of the subjects of the photograph, and how the photograph, in a sense, pulls them all together. Right, unites them. We don't think of it that way. Right? It's a snapshot, but it's conjoined the stories and literally the points of view, because you're looking through the viewfinder in the case of the photographer, what's going on. And then there's, of course, the one that concerns me almost the most in all of this is the point of view of the viewer or our readers or our students who are looking at these. And how do you make the connection there? And that's where we come back to the story and the ability for an image to connect to the moral values that the viewer has. Right? So I'm very concerned about the humanitarian, as you know, the humanitarian crisis that's unfolding in Syria right now, and have been very struck by why some images have such catalytic effects and other images do not. And so what is a viewer of the image? Most often the ones that are most disturbing are of the children. Dead children or bombed out children, children who've lost their parents in this horrible war. How do we develop or not a moral attachment to that humanitarian catastrophe? So I try to think then also about the point of view of the reader or the viewer themselves, as well as the to try to connect up Alan Kurdi. That was the most famous image of that young boy, three-year-old boy. He was a three-year-old boy washed up onto the shores of a Turkish beach that was just
horrific.
So horrific. To somebody in East Texas who sees that image on the front page of the newspaper or on their screen when they open up in their Facebook and it's that thing went viral. What's going on for them? What's going on for the viewer? And their ability to have a story that connects them, their world, and their self-interest to the other halfway around the world who's suffering. That is the test of our global consciousness. It's a complicated story, but I think that's the ground on which we are now wrestling, and how much we see what's happening in a place like Syria as a threat or as an opportunity for moral connection. It has many capacities simultaneously, and that's where the story comes in, because whether you can see it as a moral connection or as a threat to my security depends very much on the story that you coat around the image.
There's a famous Spanish proverb, ojos que no ven, corazón que no siente. Eyes that don't see, a heart that doesn't feel. These are eyes that do see. These are hearts that do feel. How do we avoid the defensive mechanism that we often fall into of finally turning away?
Yes.
And tuning out, because it's so horrible. And what can we do? What capacity have we to change this?
It's a great question. I mean, I think that. You know, one of the things we're recognizing now is that these kinds of images can anesthetize us and make us feel as tuned out as we are tuned in. It's overwhelming. How could I possibly do anything to fix that situation here? It seems so intractable and far away, and the Russians are there, and the Germans are worried about it, and Turkey and all these places. I don't know anything about. I'm just going to shut it out. I mean, I'm aware of it. The image is on my screen and on my newspaper front page. And so some images have actually the capacity to make you feel, though aware, make you feel more distant from what's happening.
So if you have an advice to our listeners, might it be that we all purchase a camera, and that we begin to learn to look with the eyes of the camera. Is this the first step toward developing the kind of sensitivity to what's happening around us, and then the moral conscience that might go with it?
Yes, I mean, I think that it's visualizing and being sensitive to what we're doing when we're visualizing, and that's what the camera helps us do. Even with your iPhone, as soon as you're taking the picture, that's what you're doing. You're thinking about the framing, the meaning, and you start to look at what's on the other side of your camera very differently. And then when you look at an image of a child washed up on a beach, think about the young Turkish photographer who's, you know, semi-employed, and she's trying to make a living, and she's living in the middle of this horrible catastrophe where bodies are washing up every morning onto the beach where she lives. And she happens to stumble out there and herself goes through a dilemma. Do I approach the child? Do I pick the child up? What's my responsibility here? I'm a professional photographer. And she's gone on record now, the one who took the photograph of Alan Kurdi, as being very upset about what she did and what she saw and having to live with herself, that her first inclination was to take the photograph and not to see if the child was alive. And she was immediately accused of this. The photographers are also in the front line of all of this debate. But when we look at the images, that we think about what's going on, what's the story here, what's the backdrop, what's the foredrop, what's mm-hmm. happening here, and what's happening in my life when I'm taking photographs of my kids or my landscape, and how we're all developing this repertoire, right, about our places in the world and what connects them. I think in this particular instance, it allows us to then start to recompose a sense of what are the stories, what are the processes that connect the stories of my life here to somebody else's story far away, and what interests do I share with those people, right? And that's where the ability to move from a image that anesthetizes us, that makes us feel distant from the subject, to one that draws out our compassion and makes us feel much more connected, that we actually have some agency and can do something about it, kicks in. Because we start to see that we have shared interests. That the fate of families in Syria is not completely severed from our own fates here. Europeans are much more aware of this because of the proximity of the Middle East to what's happening in Europe and the threat of terror and ISIS now in the big cities of Europe. So they're aware that worlds far away are not so far away anymore. I think Americans could develop a little bit more of this awareness of an interdependent world. And so that the stories of Alan Kurdi and the atrocities that are now happening in East Aleppo are connected to the kinds of debates that we're having right now in the United States about our own collective future.
If we go back a little bit to your comments about the person who takes the photograph, the, mm-hmm. the point of view of the photographer, the person who captures it, an interesting example of that phenomenon before photography, it seems to me, might be Goya and the Napoleonic Wars. Mm. Here's a man who had no camera, but he had his eyes and he had his sensitivity, and he chronicled those disasters,
yes.
which he called that, and the black paintings,
yes.
And in the end, finished his life in despair,
yes.
and horror,
yes.
almost mad,
yes.
by the power of the image as he perceived it and then communicated it.
Yeah.
What would you say to a listener who wants to avoid Goya's heightened sensitivity yeah. and therefore almost despairing response?
Yeah. Well, first of all, to listeners, check out Francisco Goya. He's really one of the great all-time painters of history. And
war and,
yes.
and disaster and pain and suffering and,
that's
and
right.
demons.
That's right. That's right. And the demons inside us. I mm-hmm. mean, they're outside us and they're inside us. And in part, some of those paintings represent the ways in which they get turned inside out. Mm-hmm. Yes, well, we could go on and on about those, the controversial paintings and how he himself felt about them and their display. But so how do we avoid despair? I mean, we could look around and see these atrocities and shrug our shoulders and just think, I'm going to defend what I can right here. Put up the barricades, keep the threats outside my world. First of all, is a recognition that that doesn't work anymore. The nature of global interdependence means you can't do that. You just can't. The idea, I'm sorry, but of building a wall and shutting out the world in an interdependent globalized system is ludicrous. So you can't. So actually, the realism is accepting the interdependence rather than the realism saying it's a nasty world out there and I'm just going to build walls. So let's be realistic. It's an interdependent world. But at the same time, understand that there are things that you can do, right? Let's just jump right to how to do things. I do a lot of work now for Syrian refugees in the area of education. One of the things I've realized is how much, for instance, just to take the refugee crisis in Syria, how overwhelmed the United Nations High Commission for Refugees and the Red Cross is. Our international organizations that we created to handle humanitarian crises like this are just right now staggered. So there are almost 5 million refugees pushed out of one country alone in the past few years, and they just don't have the capacity to handle it. And one of the dilemmas they have, and I contribute to the problem myself as I teach my course in refugee camps in Jordan, is they have very limited capacity, and they have people of very good will, like me, showing up and saying, I can do something. Help me be a good person in this refugee camp. Whoa. You know, hang on here. We've only got a staff and a half, and we've got to put out food, and we've got money. Helping organizations like the Red Cross, churches, secular organizations invest in the capacity to do something is quite easy to do, and you can do it. And it does make a difference. So, small example was that I bought boxes of a textbook that I wrote in world history, sent them off to the camps to help the students read a book while they're taking the course. There are small things we can do with material, with some material support. It's very clear that one of the things we've learned from previous incidents like this, that we have to think about, and as we hope for a post-war Syria, about the capacity to rebuild Syrian society. And so providing good health and good education for when people return to Syria in good shape, with skills, with connections to the rest of the world, will make it much easier to rebuild that shattered society. There are things we can do. It's not so impossible. As you know, Ray, I'm a possibilist, and part of the stories that we have to tell are the stories that yield to the spaces where we think we can do things, and to open those up, rather than to close them down. It's futile. It's impossible. These problems are intractable, and let's just turn inwards. I just don't think that's feasible.
Thank you, Jeremy, for coming to East Texas, for sharing with us your research and your thinking, which in the end opens our moral sensibilities in ways we didn't imagine. Our ability to understand the world we're in and the dilemmas that we face. This is the highest calling, I think we would all agree, of an education, certainly higher education, certainly the mission of the university, to expand the minds of students and all who come near. And you've certainly done it for us. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much, Ray. Thanks, everybody.
Dr. Keck, thanks a lot. The President's Perspective is produced at 88.9 KETR's studio facility in historic Binion Hall on the campus of Texas A&M University Commerce. This program and others are archived online at ketr.org. Support comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and from the listeners who support this station. I'm Jared Knight. Thanks for listening.